I'm very excited about my next guest. Award-winning journalist Patrice Gaines is an author, motivational speaker, and spiritual life coach dedicated to helping others transform their lives. Her autobiography, Laughing in the Dark, details her journey from heroin user, an abused woman, to award-winning journalist and a good mother. She is also the author of Moments of Grace, which outlines her path to change. Patrice is a reporter at the Washington Post, was a reporter at the Washington Post for 16 years. She is a justice advocate and abolitionist who believes crime can be reduced without depending on the mass incarceration of human beings. Her latest book, Say Their Names, How Black Lives Came to Matter in America, will hit the bookshelves on October the 5th. Excuse me. Patrice Gaines, welcome to Two-Way Talk.
Well, it's my pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you. I read your autobiography this week and this weekend, and I was so impressed by these incredible books, but really they are the stories of your life. You kind of lay it bare and lay out your life from the difficult decisions, bad decisions, to becoming an extraordinary journalist and advocate. Thank you for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
So tell me, protests over the killing of George Floyd have pushed to the forefront a particular fact long known by medical professionals: racism really does kill. And it may be the main cause of health disparities between whites and blacks. Can you talk a little bit about this?
Well, sure, absolutely. Yeah, it's funny. We know this in the black community.
Yes, we've known for a long time.
Yeah, because we have lived with this. And I have often said, when people ask, you know, why do we die earlier than anybody else of everything, it's because people have never really taken into account the stress and trauma that is caused by racism. Mm-hmm. And over this past couple of years, you know, when you had the pandemic, but the killing of George Floyd was just kind of, I guess, as they say, people had had enough. Gone through this over and over. There have been many other killings, but I think the fact that we were, in some ways, you know, available, our attention was because we're at home because of the pandemic,
of course.
Because many other people. That meant that many other people were watching also. That was what caused this really massive worldwide response. But indeed, black people have suffered, you know, and it comes out in diabetes and heart trouble and all kinds of other ailments, too. But, and also, you know, in mental illness, just the ways in which we have to deal daily with stress that is caused by racism.
What do you think was happening in America when the death of George Floyd happened? Everyone, world leaders, were talking about George Floyd. American leaders, from the president to members of Congress to mayors all over the country, were talking about George Floyd. What was it about what was going on at that time in America that the case of George Floyd really resonated with America?
Well, you know, there have been many, 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 many times that the black community, just regular people in the black community, as well as people who have taken leadership roles, such as the women who, created the Black Lives Matter. They tried to, when Trayvon Martin was killed, to really call attention to the fact that historically black people have been killed at a horrible rate by police. And so I think, though, everything coming together when George Floyd was killed, I think really it did have a lot to do with the fact that we were in the middle of a pandemic. and that people, you know, who would have been at work, who wouldn't have been able to get out in March, were now, you know, could get out in March. And I also have to say, I think it also has a lot to do with the fact that social media exists today.
Oh, yeah.
You know, this, one of the things we talk about in Say Their Names is the fact that this movement came together differently than the civil rights movement of the past.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that has to do with the way young people communicate and how quickly the word can spread, how quickly, you know, you can organize and say, meet me, you know, at the corner of 14th Avenue or whatever, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think all of that came together at that moment, you know, that we, that people could get together that quickly, that these young people had already been organized, you know, since Trayvon Martin and before, and that there was a pandemic. And so people had the time, and not only the time to protest, but the time to really sit and watch over and over and over while this man kept his knee on a human being, you know, neck until they died.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, all of that coming together was really what made people rise up, which is therefore what made politicians rise up. Which
yeah.
Was, you know, so. And I wanted to say also that, you know, while this new book, I am one of the co-authors, but that people should know also that my other co-authors, Curtis Bunn, Michael Codman, Nick Charles, and Keith Harrison, all the spring years of journalism to this and looked at this issue so that people would understand that this did not start with George Floyd. You know, that
That's
we
right.
know there were many things that came together that caused people to say, enough, you know, that we're tired of the inequity in every area of our lives.
I want to invite our listeners to join the conversation. I'm talking to award-winning journalist Patrice Gaines. She is one of the authors of a new book called Say Their Names, How Black Lives Came to Matter in America. That book is going to be available on October the 5th. She is with me today. 410-319-8888 is the number. If you'd like to ask any questions or you'd like to make any comments, join the conversation. Now, I'm an ordained minister, and in our church, it is so important to say their names. Many times we lose someone and transition takes place, and really speaking their names helps us with closure, but also gives us the ability to celebrate their lives, and which is very important in the Black community. Why the name Say Their Names? Make that connection for us.
Absolutely, and I think that you, are right on, because it is a tradition that we do say the names of people. You know, there's a tradition passed on, a belief that as long as you say their name, you know, that they're alive, that you're keeping that spirit alive. And, you know, there's the tradition of pouring libations and calling
That's
the name
right. That's
of,
right.
of our ancestors and others. And so it is extremely important. And then also because, you know, I think that particularly with Black people, we can call out these different names.
Mm-hmm.
And we want other people to understand. There's a reason we can. I mean, I don't think in other communities or in the white community that there are a list of names that people can call out. And there's a reason why. And there's a reason that we say their name. And, you know, there's a reason that exists, that we must even do that.
Now, I want to ask you about the book Moments of Grace, which outlines your dramatic transition. And I'm just very curious, how did that life inform your journalism, your ability to capture stories and lives? Talk a little bit about your life.
Sure. Sure. As a young woman, I began to shoot heroin. And so, you know, that changed everything because when you become a drug abuser, there's a reason, you know, generally to escape. It means you're in pain. It's so my pain came from, and only in looking back did I could I see this.
Of course, yeah.
That, you know, it came from my believing I did not have value because it's difficult for a black child to really understand that they do. I mean, we have to work with them in this society because there's so many things that say we don't. And particularly when I grew up in the 50s and 60s, it was even more true when in the 50s when I was a child. And so I did not value my life, I feel. And that caused me great pain also. It made me feel a sense of hopelessness. And this is when, you know, I came from a middle, what we call a middle class family. Mm-hmm. So I can't even imagine the trauma and hopelessness that is felt by people who don't have the kinds of opportunities that I've had in my life. But I got to the point in which I did feel this hopelessness, and I began to shoot drugs. And I got busted when I was 21, charged with possession of heroin, possession with intent to distribute, and possession of a needle and syringe, which are felonies. So I became a convicted felon. I was very fortunate that I did not have to go to prison. I was only in jail, but I became a convicted felon. I was a single mom. You know, I had maybe a $2,000 restitution I had to pay back. But I had the scar that, you know, our country will not let you forget.
I have a
conviction. And so when I began to understand how that changed the way in which people viewed me, it made me very interested eventually in trying to, you know, find out how we got to this point where we, you know, when people do make mistakes or, you know, commit a crime, we hold them accountable for the rest of their lives, punish them for the rest of their lives. You know, whether it's they're losing their voting rights or whether they can't get housing, we punish them for the rest of their lives. And so eventually I began to do a lot of, you know, advocacy work, volunteer work, as well as writing about the criminal justice system. And I was able to get off drugs, but it took time for me.
Of course.
I didn't go through a program, but it was a series of different, you know, ways of questioning myself. Therapy certainly helped me a lot. I was fortunate that I could, you know, even have therapy. And eventually writing, because writing led me to a lot of opportunities, including becoming a reporter at the Washington Post.
You are so inspiring to me. I'm just amazed that you are so, given your life, and I agree with you, sometimes we just believe that we must punish people, remind them over and over again of crimes that they committed, even when they have turned their lives around and are serving as not only an inspiration to people, but they are contributing citizens to society. And we like to remind people over and over again. Now, one thing that you did that a lot of people don't do, you wrote your story. You told your story. So nobody can hold that over you because you had something to say. And I encourage people to get the book, Moments of Grace, Meeting the Challenge to Change. And read your story. It's powerful. You're powerful.
And the memoir is called Laughing in the Dark.
That's right. From Colored Girl to Woman of Color. I love it. You really are inspirational. Let me ask you about something about the African-American community. Do you remember when Dylann Roof killed all of those members of Mother Emanuel African-American, African Methodist Episcopal Church in Charleston, South Carolina? Some of the family members were criticized, horribly criticized, because they immediately said they forgive Dylann Roof. They forgive him. They were in the courtroom. A lot of people said black people need to stop forgiving. How seriously do you take forgiveness? And is it something that the black community has to learn to do more of as we move towards reconciliation here in this country with the real painful history of African Americans in America?
Oh, my goodness, Mal. That's a... When I meet you, we can talk about that for an hour. But I'll tell you this, because it's an issue. It's something I've had to look at for a long time. Really, I've probably spent a year reading about forgiveness once, and because of just issues within my own life that I thought that I had released and forgiven. So I think the thing about... being black in America is, of course, we could say, you know, there's so much to forgive.
Yes,
but I
right.
think to understand really what forgiveness is, none of us, in a way, black, white, are really taught about what true forgiveness is. So people see forgiveness as a sign of weakness. And they think it means you're not holding the person accountable,
mm-hmm.
or it means that they don't have to pay in any way for what, you know, the crime, the sin, the whatever that their actions. But that's not at all what forgiveness says. It's really a great spiritual release for the person who is suffering. Say in my own case, in my lifetime, I was raped, and I remember immediately thinking, because I was raised a Christian, mm-hmm. that I needed to forgive this person. But later on, I understood that what I had done really was not forgiving them. I had kind of gone through the motion and said in my head, oh, I'm going to forgive them because I know that's what I need to do.
Mm-hmm.
But I was still suffering, playing this over in my head, the anger, the hatred, the resentment,
mm-hmm.
Over and over. So my lack of true forgiveness, of understanding what it was hurting me. It was not hurting that person
mm-hmm.
at all. And so I think that what true forgiveness does is it releases the person who is suffering. It allows them to let go of what has happened in a way that they are able to gain back all the power that they had, you know, and
mm-hmm.
that understanding that God, the universe, the cords, the whatever, the system will take care of this other person,
mm-hmm.
but you do not have to carry that resentment. Now, so it was funny. I wrote a story about the 1 year anniversary of that shooting,
mm-hmm.
and there were people who expressed forgiveness. And the editors I was writing for, that I wrote for, they were very interested in that, you know, because,
of course.
Oh, how can, you know,
how can
they
people forgive?
Yeah, how can they forgive? And they were, in some ways, they were way more interested in it in some ways than I was, because not everybody did, and I think that's fine. There's a process that people have to go through for their own healing.
That's right.
You know, to even be able... And sometimes you can mouth the words "I forgive" and really not even be there. I'm me questioning the sincerity of these
folks. Of course.
I don't
mm-hmm.
know, but I do know that you can mouth those words and not understand what it truly means. And then just a quick, and this is just a weird, maybe I don't know, metaphysical, whatever. Sorry, but I was once in a car accident. A bus hit me, totaled my car.
Wow.
And I remember that on my way home, I had to rent a car to come on home. I was up in D.C. in Maryland, actually, coming back to, I live in South Carolina, right outside of Charlotte, North Carolina. And on my way back, I was like praying, going, "My God, you know, I do everything you say. Why would you allow this to happen mm-hmm. to me?" And what I was told was that I needed to forgive. And I said, "What is I haven't forgiven?" And I heard a voice that said to me that when what happened was, first I was shown the accident all over. And what I realized was I was at the stoplight, and I did stop at the stoplight. Mm-hmm. But when the light turned, I stepped on the gas. I had the green light. But I saw the bus coming. And that in my head, I said, "Oh, no, you're not.
No, you're not going
to." And I didn't realize this until it was shown to me after this prayer. Mm. And what I came to learn, what I was told after much, you know, prayer and looking at this, was that the bus at that time did not represent a bus. It represented everybody who had ever stepped on me, seen me as invisible, just rolled over me, treated me like I didn't exist. And that was why I needed to forgive, so that I could see the world clearly, so that I could really see what was happening. So I would only say that, you know, having anger can cloud your vision. Having, you know, hurting from something that you can release, that you have this power to release and forgive, mm-hmm. Can hurt how you view things, and, you know, could stop you from... It could make a bus hit you. And I know, you know, that's a lot to unpack.
That is.
Process it, but, you know, I just say forgiveness is forgiving the person a new life, the mm-hmm. person who is doing the forgiving. It's forgiving them a new life, not necessarily for the other person. So
I will tell you, and I'll explain more when we do meet, because I can't wait to meet you. I went through a horrible experience in my professional career where I was accused of something horrible. And it hung around me, cost me my job, a very good, prominent job as a spokesperson for the city of Baltimore. And I was more interested in people knowing that I forgave this person that did this than actually forgiving them. I was more caught up in being a Christian and doing the right thing, and how big am I that I can forgive this person who cost me so much? And I didn't forgive them. I didn't until God really revealed to me that I'm not going to move past all of that pain, that suffering, all of it, until I really do forgive. So those words mean a lot to me, Patrice.
I understand it, but that's what we aren't taught.
We're not taught.
Yep. We're taught. You know, that's a sign of weakness. Or you just forgive them, like as if just saying it does
makes it happen.
Yeah.
It's interesting. Now I want to talk to you real quick, because we only have a couple of minutes left, about equal media coverage between people of color, black and brown people, and white people. Last week, there was a white woman who was missing, and she was found, and there was so much media coverage. And then there were black families, Latino families, Native American families that really stood up and said, "Wait a minute, why aren't you covering my child is missing? They've been missing for 2 years, 3 years, and we've not been able to get any media coverage." Do you see that improving, or is it just that the racist nature of life that black families don't get the same equal treatment in the media that white families get?
Well, you know, it's funny, and say their names, what we talk about is all the many ways in which white supremacy manifests.
Uh-huh.
The belief that one life, a white life, is worth more than a black life, and it manifests in so many ways, including coverage by the media, which also always causes more people to get involved.
Oh, yeah.
Police to up their game. I mean, all kinds of things because of that do not occur when a black life isn't given as much value, which means it doesn't receive as much coverage or attention. And so, you know, it's great that we have this discussion for a second because of this, but it's something that has to, you know, has to keep, we have to keep this up, and we have to build institutions or networks within our communities also to support people who find themselves in a situation where they are looking for their loved ones who are people who are Black and brown people.
So very true. Now, I don't want us to miss an opportunity to really promote this book, Say Their Names, How Black Lives Came to Matter in America. What do you want people to take from when they pick up and buy this book? What do you want them to take from these stories that you all share?
Well, and one thing I do want to say is they can pre-order this now from any bookstore, from Amazon, but from also their local bookstores. Well, I hope there's also some comfort in this book, because we, when we deal with everything, whether it's the wealth gap, whether it's my chapter is called Locking Up Black Lives, when we deal with health care, we talk to people also who are working to change the inequities, and we talk to them about what they believe needs to be done, what their vision of the future, the vision of what change looks like. And so I would hope that they would also see in here some of the visionaries who are working, some of the Black visionaries who are working now on all of these issues, whether it's the criminal justice system or, you know, whether it's organizing the Black community, it's the health inequity. There's a section on the Black church and what it needs to do to be able to support the movements and the kind of work that young people see that needs to be done now. So hopefully they will see the whole arc, you know, bending toward justice. That they will see that and feel hopeful that they'll understand, you know. I look at it in some ways, I'm really proud that I was able to participate, because I look at it like a lot of the things that I've written about over the years, different stories, and like there's a chapter in here, one of the writers, Keith Harrison, writes about policing. But the thing is, it's all together here so that you see. I write about the history of punishment in this country, of criminal justice, from whether it was slavery in the South to the first penitentiary in the North, and how those merged, that whole sense of who can be punished and, you know, how much they can be. And so I think they'll find, you know, some history that they didn't know, or some thoughts that will hopefully provoke them to take action. But they'll also see, some hope that from visionaries who are doing the work today.
We'll end on this. I just got a text from one of our listeners who says she grew up with you in Prince George's County. She said that she found you to be beautiful, smart, and hip, and your life story has been nothing short of inspirational. I will share her name with you. She's one of my mentors and heroes, but she said that she just finds your life inspirational.
I did grow up in TPC, so somebody who knows.
That's right. Make sure you get this book. You can order it now. Say Their Names, How Black Lives Came to Matter in America. Patrice Gaines is one of the authors featured in this book. Make sure you go get it. And if you Google her name, you'll get all of the books that she's written. She is quite an inspiration. Patrice Gaines, thanks for joining me today.
Oh, thank you so much, and thank you for the work you do there.
Thank you. It's wonderful to when you get a chance to promote great people like you. So it makes my job fun. Thank you for your time. We need to take a very quick break. Let's go to my friend Amy for the MTA report.
Good afternoon, folks. On LiveRailLink, that work we've had for that work we've had for that work we've had for